My name is Alex Stamos, and this is Attacking Web Services. Is that a good volume for you guys? Okay, great. This is a session from 11 to 12:50-ish. We'll probably run a little bit early, but I'll be available for Q&A afterwards. And my email address is in here, so at any time, please feel free to drop me an email. Also, I want to make this an interactive thing. It's really hard to judge, especially when you do like background information, what people's backgrounds are. So please raise your hand, or if I don't notice, just yell out a question if you have it any time during the presentation, okay? So I was joking about the whole Cisco thing. Obviously, Cisco doesn't deploy any web service boxes, so fortunately. So what are we going to talk about? I'm going to talk about who I am. My speaking partner, Scott, was supposed to be here. He did a lot of this work. I need to give him a shout-out, but I let him go to his engagement party so he doesn't get divorced because of DEF CON. So talk about what we do, what web services are, where they're being used. Talk about the basic technologies and new attacks that we're now seeing in the deployment of these technologies, as well as traditional attacks that we've lived with for a long time, especially traditional web applications, that now can be retooled a bit to work in the web services XML world. And then we'll be doing a couple of demos. So it looks like the network's up for now, so we should be able to do a couple of those. If you want to play along, there's an URL in here. You can start downloading our software off the web and the 19 different Python packages you need to make it run. And if somebody actually gets it running, you can play along while we do the demo. And like I said, please interrupt at any time if you guys need something. So who are we? Or I, my founding partner of ISAC Partners. We're all ex-stakers, all wounded children from the at-stake Symantec merger. Based on the West Coast, we do consulting and research, mostly in application security. What are we going to talk about? Well, we're talking about web services. And why is that important? Well, they're deployed all around us, and it's kind of this stealth deployment that a lot of people don't realize, especially a lot of people in the security community. If you're in the enterprise security community or if you're an enterprise developer, I'm sure you've heard the term SOAP or XML from a manager or had to buy a book about it. But it's not something that there's been a lot of security research in. We're not saying that this is definitely not the definitive talk that's going to be given on web services over the next decade. This is the first run through. We found some bugs. There's some interesting stuff going on. But really what we're trying to do is create interest about web services in the security community and kick off research by other people, because there's a lot we don't know. There's tons of acronyms out there that need to be attacked. And we're looking for your guys' help. So like I said before, the latest version of these slides is that the CD is way old. isacpartners.com/defcon.html. If you go to isacpartners.com, you can click all the way through speak engagements. And then there's a demo web service at wsdemo.isacpartners.com/xpathservice/xpathservice.asmx. I will concede right now that there's somebody in this room with a botnet that could destroy this machine and make the data center itself fall into the gaping maw of the earth. And I concede you're a bigger man than I. Please don't sin flood it or anything. I'd like people to be able to play around with it, okay? So this talk is supposed to be not only talking about the security stuff, but we're going to try to do a background on the relevant technologies, because like I said, a lot of people, especially in the security community, haven't been exposed to them yet, right? It's not something that you get off a CD. It's not something that ships with your Dell. It's generally not something that you can download off of BitTorrent, and therefore it's not something that gets researched very much, right? And so we'll give a little background on that. Please let me know if you have any questions, because I don't want to spend too much time on that, especially for the people here who are experienced in web services. Then we'll talk about some of the security risks that are associated with web services. A lot of them sound pretty much familiar, because a lot of technologies are familiar or built upon older technologies. But there's lots of different things. And like I said, I think there's going to be a lot of stuff in the next several years, both attacks enabled through web services at applications that are insecure or in the frameworks and technologies themselves. This is not a talk about the WS- security standards. That's a class of standards that does like encryption, allows you to do authentication and authorization, all that kind of stuff. They're pretty interesting. They do all kinds of stuff. They come in books 700 pages long. Nobody deploys them. So that's one reason not to talk about them. But they're also about things like being able to do legal signatures online using a web service, which has nothing to do with actually attacking or defending that application. Just because you have XML signing digital signatures enabled doesn't mean you can't attack it, right? Just as if you have SSL on your web application and there's a little lock in Internet Explorer doesn't mean your application is secure. It's kind of the equivalent. So this isn't a talk about that, which is good because you people would leave. So what are web services? It's a very overloaded term, mostly because you can get millions of dollars thrown at you by venture capitalists if you put the words web services and Indian programmers like in your prospectus. For our purposes, web services, our communication protocols are based on XML. That's pretty much the only standard we'll be talking about that's universal. Lots of people do all kinds of weird web services, not like SOAP or any definitions, but just moving XML files around using HTTP or even SMTP, and they call it web services. That's fine. But for our purposes, we're going to talk about XML as the base language. They provide computer-to-computer communication, which is an important point to understand and kind of underlies a lot of the security issues, is that these are things that are not meant to be consumed by human beings, at least not initially, right? It's not like moving HTML over HTTP, where the goal of the HTML is to be rendered into something that a human being could read, right? A web service might, you know, be rendered into a GUI or something, but maybe not. And a lot of the technologies are based upon the idea that human beings don't have to be involved. Which is both scary for programmers who want to be in their jobs, but it's also scary from a security standpoint. They use standard protocols. They're often controlled by the W3C, OASIS, and WSI. Web services as a technology has more acronyms than I've seen anywhere else. It is unbelievable. It's not my fault. I just want to say that up front. Blame Tim Berners-Lee. And they're designed to be platform and transport independent. Although a lot of these standards have been made by like IBM, or one standard's been made by Microsoft, all of them are generally accepted and patent-free and able to be deployed by anybody. And that's kind of like what makes them powerful and makes them so compelling. Why are they compelling? Well, you know, these web services are based upon some pretty well-understood technologies, right? How many people here have ever edited or created an XML file? Right, a lot of people, right? That's great. That doesn't mean that you've done web service programming, but you now have a basic knowledge that a lot of people inherited from the HTML worlds anyway to get into it. The adoption of web services has been very, very quick by large software vendors. The whole creation of these standard bodies has gotten rid of the not invented here syndrome. So Microsoft and IBM are willing to implement it without either one of them taking credit for the other guy's inventions. That's a pretty unique in the security or in the software industry. One of the reasons they're compelling is that they're described as kind of a panacea for interoperability issues, both internal to the enterprise and externally. And we'll talk about some scenarios of that. But probably why they're most compelling is the magic pixie dust, right? This is the same magic security pixie that comes by when you plug your computer into the wall at Caesars, and it automatically gets an IP address, and then it's automatically able to talk to the gateway, even though it doesn't know the MAC address through this crazy little pixie dust protocol called ARP, right? It's all these magic pixie dust protocols that make things happen magically and automatically and without human intervention that create insecurities, right? Because there's nothing secure about plugging into any network in the world. And that's because everything has always been built to be easy. And easy is bad, right? If there's not a human being involved saying, yes, you're allowed to do that, then that's a bad thing. And there's tons of magic pixie dust in this. For example, this is a little, 10 or 12 lines of C#. Open up, anybody has MSDN installed, open up Visual Studio right now. If you create a new project, you point it at something that has a web server, IIS6 installed, and it's got ASP.NET activated. If you set up that project, you copy and paste this into a file, you compile it. It will automatically compile the C# into CLR, create an ASP page that corresponds with that C# file, create a configuration file, create a web discovery document called a DISCO file, create a WSDL, which is the web service document language, which we'll talk about, load all these up. If you have a UDDI server, it'll automatically register with UDDI, and you'll now have a function that if somebody over the internet can send a message to IIS, which then hands it up to an XML parser, which hands it to a SOAP handler, which then finally hands it to your program, which gives it a string, and then it goes all the way back down, right, with 10 lines of programming. And there's then millions of lines of code running around it, that's a lot of magic pixie dust. And that's the kind of stuff that we'll be talking about today. And another reason that you see them all over the place is the value is really well understood by the pointy-haired bosses. This is just a little fake quote, but this is, you know, something that we actually see, right? I see a couple gray hairs and ponytails in here, so those are people that might actually know what Kix is. It's a crazy little programming language for mainframes, but you can't hire people that do it anymore, right? All those guys are retired after all the Y2K money they made. And so a lot of these enterprises have these IBM boxes from the 70s that their whole enterprises are running on. Now, it's their their stock trading system or your health records or a bank, your bank account numbers, are all in a mainframe. And they can't hire people to talk to the mainframe. So what do? Well, you go buy some IBM products because IBM is able to take machines they sold in the 70s and continually make money off of them. You go buy an IBM product and some IBM Global Services guys, and they come over and they put some WebSphere right in front of it, and they create the SOAP interface by which, just using XML and HTTP, you can talk to the mainframe. And now I can get all these guys that have Learn Java in 30 Days books and have them write all my new enterprise applications to talk to the mainframe. Don't need to get any of those gray-haired ponytail guys. And that is very, very compelling to corporate management, right? Because they want to extend stuff and they don't want to spend money. Okay. So I have been told, I mean, this was all prearranged, obviously. This is issue number 13, numbered. Independent. I'm sorry. It's the last issue of FRAC, numbered 13. They're individually numbered. It's still warm from the printing press, and it's incredible leetness. Oh. And it will be given to somebody in this room today. And I have to come up with a competition while I'm talking to you guys in my head about how we'll do that. So we'll have some kind of hacking competition at the end. Let me think about how we'll do it. But pay attention, because it'll have to do something with the slides, okay? Please don't mob me. Slow down. There's a lot of security guys here. I know you want it, but put it here so you guys can look at it. Okay. So now we're going to talk about web services are being used, right? Where are you going to run into it? Like I said, web services are not something that you consciously run into like you run into RPC and Windows, right? If you're a hacker and you use Windows and you've ever done a file transfer, you probably understand like ports 137, 139, Samba and stuff. It's a technology you run into. But a lot of people in here have not run into web services, even though most likely everybody in here, either your credit report, your social security number, your tax information, your bank information, it's been moved over a web service protocol at one time or another. So where are they being used? Between companies. This is a big mover. This is the whole B2B thing, right? Which meant business to business. Then it meant back to banking after the dot-com boom, bust. But now it means business to business again. And people are doing this using web services, right? That we got a pass, not invented here, so you can get your vendor to support it. And it gets rid of these stupid protocols that people invented. I mean, they're not stupid, but these incredibly complex, dense binary protocols like EDI and stuff and all the X protocols that people have talked from company to company. You can get rid of those, and now you can write it in nice and easy XML. You can read it in English. Uses HTTP. Everybody knows how that works. It's based upon a web browser. Much easier for people to use than these old protocols to talk from business to business. A great example, the credit card companies have these weird binary packed, ultra-small formats for doing credit card clearing. Well, they're also moving to doing web service stuff. So the credit card clear, when your order comes in, can talk to the bank, which can talk to the credit bureau, which can talk to the lender, and all this can happen over SOAP, and you can write it all in Java, and you don't have to buy a specific product for the credit card industry. You can just buy WebSphere or ASP.NET and write it on top of that. Internal to companies, a lot of people like to hook their stuff up, right? I want my payroll system to work with my inventory system. Web services to connect those, instead of people having to understand each other's formats. And for the legacy systems, I already told you about this. Mainframes, AS400s, all that kind of stuff. Between tiers of web applications, and this is a really interesting one for some of the bugs we're talking about, a lot of people are moving towards using XML, an XML data format on the back end. So if you do something on a web application, that XML data goes somewhere. Now, it might go to an XML-enabled database, which can mean anything from a database that can understand XML and put it into a normal table, to being transported somehow and then eaten up by a middle-tier software or something like that. This makes the X injections, and I mean X star, all there's different kinds of protocols here, injections into those protocols, very interesting. And the way that most of the people have here, who here has used Google Maps? Who here has used Gmail? Right, so you guys have used web services, right? Those are AJAX applications, asynchronous JavaScript and XML. They don't use SOAP or any of like the heavy-duty web service, but it's still a web service. The really cool for people who haven't noticed. These are applications that allow you to do all kinds of interactive stuff without reloading the page constantly, right? And it works. Microsoft came out with Internet Explorer, has the ability to talk to what's called the XML HTTP object, and now Mozilla now simulates that and stuff, even though it's obviously not ActiveX. But basically, I can give you an HTML page once. It has a bunch of JavaScript in it. That JavaScript talks to this object in the browser, which actually does all of its communication. And it's able to move XML files back and forth over HTTP. And it can do that without reloading. It can do it asynchronously. So it can do it multiple times, right? You scroll around in Google Maps, and it can spawn a bunch of these XML HTTP objects to load up the address separately from loading up the pictures to loading up this and that. And it gives you a great end-user experience. A lot of people are using this in enterprises as a replacement for thick clients, right? If I don't want to use a SAP doesn't want to have to ship an end client for Macs and Linux and Windows. They'd rather ship something that just loads into Mozilla on all those platforms and allows you to have the same kind of user experience, which, you know, the user experience kind of sucked in web applications because of reloading and the back button and stuff, and you can get rid of that. There are some definite interesting security issues with Ajax. We'll talk about that a bit. A lot of this stuff is also about the heavy-duty protocols like SOAP. So what's the point of this? The code is broken free, right? One of the reasons people like web services is you do lots of powerful stuff over one port, right? Because back in the day, everybody put their whole enterprises on the internet. Then they, you know, heard of this thing called a firewall, and they hired some firewall guys, and they paid Cisco some money, and they installed a firewall. And now if you look at the outside of a normal corporation, you'll generally just see SMTP, HTTP, HTTPS, every once in a while a firewall one management port. But you don't see things like RPC open to the internet. Well, it's open to the internet again now, right? You're moving it over a different protocol, but now with web services, you can move all this stuff over ports that people have had closed. And that's actually an advertisement for some of these products, right? Get around your firewall engineers. Buy our web service product. So our new slogan is we poke holes in your firewall so you don't have to, right? Just set up your firewalls once, fire your network engineers, add all your functionality to a SOAP interface, and you're done. So now we're going to talk about some of these technologies, give you a little background and the attacks with each. So XML. Everybody here kind of knows what XML is. It's this incredibly complex standard for representing all the data in the known universe, right? Which sounds like a really easy problem for them to tackle. Especially if it's supposed to be like English readable too on top of it. And it's very hard work, right? You got things like binary data, internationalization. XML has internationalization built in from the beginning, right? Unicode 1.0 is the standard for XML. With XML 1.1, it'll be Unicode 2.0. This makes internationalization attacks really interesting, right? Because we've seen these attacks before, things like non-minimal UTF-8 encodings, doing things like changing character sets to do like SQL injection and cross-site scripting. That's always been kind of stapled on because internationalization was stapled on to web apps. With web services, internationalization is from the beginning. And so if you talk to something that understands XML, it probably understands all those character sets. You no longer have to get lucky, like somebody installed the Japanese character set pack on SQL Server, but you used to have to get. So that's a really big deal for internationalization attacks, which have been covered by other people, but definitely move over to web services. You have to represent meta characters. You have to be able to define and validate how these documents are, yada, yada. Because of the size of the product space, we've ended up with dozens and dozens of standards. And very few people understand a lot of them, and there's nobody who understands all of them. Which is a little different than web applications, right? Because it's pretty easy to understand both HTML and HTTP. Okay, I can understand how those work. I mean, maybe I can't recite the RFCs, but it's almost impossible to do that with web services. There's a couple basic strict rules. Why do you guys care about it? Well, when you're attacking a web service interface, you generally have to use legal XML. If you don't, you're just attacking the parser. And people have done that. People have written part things that do all kinds of wacky stuff with XML. But people have done that before, right? What we're trying to get to is the applications behind that standard XML parser. I'm not going to walk you guys through how this works, but here's a simple element in an XML tag, right? That's called the parent node. Those are called children nodes. Here's a full legal document. It does things like define the encoding. This is obviously Latin character set 1 for us English speakers. The default encoding for XML is UTF-8, which is great. This is the definition of a namespace. This XML document belongs to this namespace, so you can, like, if I had manufacturer shouldn't overlap with somebody else's namespace of an XML document. I also define a schema by which this can be, these URLs aren't real, don't try to go grab them, a schema by which this document can be verified. Schemas are the way you verify documents. DTDs are the old way. It was a non-XML base. There's this weird thing with colons and stuff. The great thing with DTDs is there's a number of nasty attacks that have mostly been fixed, but as people come out with new XML parsers, they might be in there again. One of the attacks was to make a self-referencing DTD that could say, I define the type B, and then B defines type C, which defines type D, which types E, and then E defines something that has a subtype A. And you can get the DTD parsers to infinitely loop. You could also reference things that are external to the DTD, but most of these things have been fixed already. XSDs, XML schema documents, are XML-based. They're the new way of doing it. The important thing for security people to understand is that from a defense perspective, XML schemas can actually be very powerful. From an attacker's standpoint, nobody uses them, so who cares? Like I said, they can prevent many of the attacks we're going to discuss. So if you are on the defense side, think about validating stuff with a strong schema, and don't do stupid stuff like having the all tag and stuff like that. We'll talk about that later. This is a schema. It's pretty readable. The only interesting thing here is I have a restriction that I have an element called year. I'm saying it has to be an integer and it has to be between these dates. This means I can't do SQL injection, right, in the integer field. If I give it something that looks like a string, the XML parser itself is going to die before it ever gets close to the database. So here's a little bit of a protection. Most people don't do this kind of stuff. The magic pixie dust that we talked about generally doesn't include XML schemas. So parsing. So I get an XML document, how do I read it? There's kind of two standard ways. Both ways have security flaws. The first one's called SACS, Simple API for XML, I think it is. This is a step-by-step stateless parser that expects you to store the state, right? It's kind of like a thing I say, go one more step, Oh, you have children node? Okay, I want that child, right? So when people use it's nice and it's lightweight, it's pretty easy to use, but it's not very powerful, and it has the downside of if you use a SACS parser, you have to track what data you've gotten, right? If I want to get out of that car, if I want to get manufacturer, I have to say car, okay, I got car, I want the child name manufacturer. It gives me manufacturer, and then I have to store it in a variable for myself, right? And there's an attack against that called XML injection that we'll talk about. And then the other one is DOM, Document Object Model. This is really powerful parsing. This is how most people do it in enterprise applications, and that turns out to be a bad thing from a denial of service standpoint, because if I have a big XML document, what this means is it takes and it builds a data structure in memory that represents it, right? It represents all the nodes that are linked to all the child nodes. It's linked to this. It's linked to this. And each one of those nodes is a data is an object in Java with its own, garbage collection and all the information that gets wrapped around any variable in Java. So DOM has issues with denial of service. And then there's always a really bad idea. People make their own parsers with like regex and stuff. Don't do it. You can get a XML parser for every language. There's no reason to do it again because you'll probably screw it up. So an attack against SACS, XML injection. So this is a situation in which if the attacker can control a string that gets put into an XML document, there's multiple ways this can happen. This can be an XML document that is standing in for like a database query. If I send, maybe it's my user login, and it puts the login information I give it, and it puts in an XML document and hands it off somewhere else to get parsed. Or it could be something like a document I upload because that's how I upload data. It could be a lot of things. But anyway, if I can control text in it, and it's not being input filtered, I can put more XML tags in there. So in this situation, we have a user record. Let's say this is a bank, and I've created my user because I have a bank account. And so I go in and I now create my web user, and it asks me for something like my email address. And so when I fill out my email address, I give it an email address, and then I close the email tag, and I create a new tag called unique ID, and then I say the email again, this is for the parser. Why did I put this unique ID in here? Well, this is in a situation where perhaps I have some knowledge of how the XML document's laid out. I know that there's a unique ID child node in there that defines what my ID is. This is like a unique ID that's used by the application itself. And so with a SACS parser, if I was writing a SACS parser to read this generally, and remember this is a fault with the application, not the parser itself, but we see it over and over again because people don't expect this, is you step through the document and you go to user record and you say, give me the first tag. And it says, okay, tag is unique ID, value is this. And so I write it to a temporary variable. And then I say name. And I write that to a variable. And I say email. And I write that to a variable. And then I get to unique ID again. And because the parser itself isn't tracking the state, I'm just going through and have a switch statement that says, when I get this information, put it into a variable. I overwrite that information and put the zero back in. So who do you guys think zero, user zero is on a web application? It's the admin. Almost always, right? This is the same kind of, when you do SQL injection, you do or 1 equals 1, it gets the first user in the table, and it always turns out to be either like the developer or an admin. It's the same kind of problem. And so the SAX parser, if I step through like this and store it in variables, gives me a unique ID of zero. How do you defend against this? You can do an XML schema where you say you can only have one unique ID per user record, or you can use a DOM parser, which you would specifically reference one of these, and it would probably choke. Yes, sir? No, I'm sorry. So this red, you're right. That's an excellent question. Why not do unique ID zero in the first place? This red area is the only part I control. So this is a web, I'm imagining this is a web form that's taking my information and putting it into an XML document where it stores all my information about my bank account. Does everybody understand that? So I can only control what's between these two tags because it takes my data and puts it in. And as you see, I have to do the email twice so that there's not this hanging email tag out here, which will make it choke probably, right? So like I said, for defense, you can do an XML schema validation, or you can use a DOM parser, or you can go through and check to make sure that you don't get multiple inputs. This also works with XPath, which we'll talk about. So if I did this attack and somebody was trying to pull this information out using XPath, even with a DOM parser, the attack would probably work as well. So, which takes us to XPath. XPath is this very simple language by which people are supposed to be able to reference what's in an XML document. It's kind of a cross between direct relations and regex. XPath number one was supposed to be nice and simple. It has like 20 pages of documentation, the standard. XPath two is something like 300 pages, and nobody's read them all yet. So I'm not sure what's in it, but it looks really scary, some of this stuff in two. But these attacks work on XPath one. So say this was our car example. XPath entries are something like, so I get this XML, this is part of it. I load it into a parser, and then I want to ask the parser for information from the XML document. And so one of the things I might ask for is, let's say there's a bunch of car nodes, right, in this document. It's a big list of used cars. I want to return all of the children of the node. XPath queries always return a list. It might be, it's like MATLAB or something. It might be a list of one item, but always returns a list, which is really interesting because if I just say car, it gives me all of them in a big list, all of these nodes. If I do slash car, that just gives me the root element, right? Only the first one. If I do slash slash car, it does all the car elements in the document. I'm sorry, car. If you say just car, it's all the children of the car. Car slash slash color will give me all the color underneath car. And then the interesting one is when you can have conditionals. Give me search for car and give it to me the list of cars where color equals blue, right? And you can actually do pretty complex queries in here. And as you can see, this is really, really cool, right? Because this makes it really easy to get information out of an XML document. Because this is a pretty easy to understand language, and if my document's not incredibly complex, this is much easier to use than doing all these, Python or C# calls to the DOM parser. What's the downside? We'll get to that in a second. So where do people use XPath? People often use it to talk to databases. It's starting to replace SQL in situations where people are storing XML data in a database. All of these, XPath is supported by all of these database servers. I think you need like SP3 or something for 2000. So what's the problem? Well, like our old friend SQL from SQL injection, XPath puts data and the command you want to do, it puts the verb and the noun right next to each other. And those are delineated by our old friend, the single quote. Right? So if I want to say, give me the car where the color is blank, I use the single quote to say, this blank describes the car. That's not a command I want you to run. That's a description. Unlike SQL, there is no access control in XPath or XML documents. So generally, if you run an XPath query against an XML document, you can read everything in that document. That's good, right? Because sometimes SQL injection just doesn't work because they have good database schema. That doesn't exist here. There's also no real safe way of using XPath, right? A lot of times we'll do a pen test. We won't find SQL injection. We'll say, hey, no SQL injection. Congrats. You must be doing really good input filtering. And they'll be like, input what? And we'll say, well, why don't we have SQL injection? Well, it turns out because they want things to run faster, they use prepared statements or they call in stored procedures, and that's a nice secure way of doing it, and SQL injection doesn't work in that case. There's nothing like that for XPath. There's no secure way to call it. The way people always call it is you concatenate a bunch of strings together, and then you give that string to the parser, right? Which is the bad way of using SQL. That's the only way to use XPath. So the outcome is if I can control any data that gets into an XPath statement and I can get a quote in, I can return arbitrary data and access arbitrary stuff in the document itself. And here's the example. So in this example, say it's this bank again, and I've created an XML document. I don't need a database, right? Because I'm a small bank. So I just keep a flat XML document of all my users. I've already been XML injected, so I fixed that, right? Oh, I was so stupid. I should have known that people couldn't gone stuff in. And so I fixed it by going over to a DOM parser, a nice big complicated parser that you can't do XML injection against. But since it's so hard to use, I'm going to use XPath to get information out of it instead of stepping through it step by step. And so one of the things that I have to do is when people log in, I have to go see if they're in this big flat XML file of users. Everybody with me so far? Okay. Yeah. Great hypothetical, huh? Real original. So I'm going to create an XPath statement and then give it to my parser, and it's going to look up the user for me. And so I'm going to say /user, search for the user whose name is equal to Joe and whose password is equal to let me in. And the two red things here are information that come from the web form, the login and the password field. Okay, that's fine. It works. This will return a list of all the users, right? Because it's /, it'll be a list of all the users that match that. It's probably only one. It should be. But it does return a list of one element. So now we come to our new canonical statement that will replace, if you're really, really cool, quote, what's the canonical SQL statement? This will be the first point for getting the book. Raise your hand. Yes, sir, back there. And then what after it? Right, --, and maybe semicolon --, depending on it, right? So this is our new statement. Everybody memorize it, put it on t-shirts. I have to get money from the t-shirts, but I've actually seen that like on t-shirts, which is horrible about me and my social life, but this is our new canonical statement that will tell us if XPath injection is working. Single quote or 1=1. Hey, that sounds familiar. Or single quote, that's not a double quote, that's 2 single quotes, =1 single quote. I know you, not everybody can see it, but download the PDF, it'll be in there. So what this does is now I have, give me all the users whose name equals Joe, and my first single quote closes out the Joe string, or 1=1, which is a what's the word for something that's always true? Tautology. It's a tautology. Something that's always true, so this always returns true. Or, quote equals quote quote. Why do I need that quote equals quote? Anybody? To get rid of the last quote, right. So I don't have, XPath doesn't have the ability to do comments in line like SQL. So I can't use the --, which we used for SQL injection, to throw away the rest of the line, or a semicolon to make mine a statement and then make the next one a different statement. I have to actually use what's in my application. And so the easy way to do that, I've got a single quote floating out there, is I create an empty string, and then I create another empty string using that single quote. So only the red stuff I control, that last black one is put in there by the application, but I neutralize it by doing this. And password let me in. So why does this work? Because it's an or and. Anybody? Why would this work? Well, the end's not quoted out. The end's used, but sorry? Operator precedence. Somebody took a first year CS class and hated it. Right, sir? Yes, operator precedence. The thing that bites you in your ass when you start CS. When you look at this, it first does the and. There's a implied parentheses around this. So the and is the first thing. Quote, quote, and pass equals let me in. So this turns to a not. But then we have false or true or false, which turns into true. And so what this does is returns all of the users because it is a tautology. It returns a list of all the users. Well, what use is that? Well, like I said, XPath, everything's a list. So if I'm using XPath to log somebody in, I have to take a list, and what do I have to do with it? Well, not to protect, but what do I have to do, like, just to use it normally? I have to ask for the first element and then use that as the login, right? So I just ask for the first element anyway, and the first guy who's returned becomes my login user. That makes sense to everybody? Right? A lot of people yelled at me at Black Hat because they're like, how could it work? Because it returns multiple things. Well, you know, unlike SQL, in this situation, everything is a list, so I'm going to take this output and ask, what's the number one guy, and use that person, the first child. Thank you. So if we want to get all super powerful, we can do things like now change and put more stuff in there. This is obviously much more useful if you have access to information with it, and you know how the XML is laid out. So if this is a open source or a commercial product that you can get your hands on, and you can figure out how the XML is laid out. And we can do things like create more rules and change around the statement to do all kinds of cool stuff. And we'll do that. I'll show a demo of that later. So what's the, like SQL injection, you know, this requires some knowledge of the query, which makes it much easier if error messages are on. How many people in here are going to vote that that they don't give you all the information by default in all the major web service stacks? Anybody want to take that bet against me? I'll give you 10-1 odds. Nobody. Okay, that's true. The default is give them all the information they need to make an XPath query, and we'll show you on a default ASP.NET. Even if you can't get access to it, Amit Klein, who used to be of Sanctum, I guess he's not there anymore, which is now WatchFire, which is now probably today it's VeriSign, and tomorrow it'll be part of Time Warner. I don't know what's going on in the security industry while I'm here. But he wrote an excellent paper called Blind XPath Injection. Drop that into Google and you'll find it. He claims he has a way of getting the entire XML document out bit by bit by creating a conditional that's set on what the next character is. And so whether you log in or not is that one bit of covert channel you get out. Of course, it like they had like a test of like there's 40 characters after, and it took like 2 hours to get those 40 characters out because you have to do all the logins and test all possible characters, but it's pretty cool. If anybody knows him, I'm trying to find him, have him release the tool, please, so we can play with it. But XPath 2 might give us a lot more ways of actually getting all that information out. XPath 2 does a lot of cool things, like you have the ability to reference outside documents. I can have tests that ask for information from an outside document, right? Like if this user is equal to the user in this. Now, the control of where that outside document comes from isn't really defined by the standard, right? That's going to have to be up to the people that write the implementation themselves. So how many people want to bet that at some point you're going to be able to get a document from your web server, right? And that way I'd probably be able to leak a bunch of information out about the rest of the XML. The future, if you guys want to be really, really elite and get the next t-shirt before this t-shirt that's going to come out after this t-shirt, is XQuery injection. XQuery is a superset of XPath that is now the standard for talking to XML databases. One of the really cool things it can do is you can reference a bunch of different documents and stuff. Downside is now people are actually building access control in Sabuhu. We won't be able to read everything, but that hasn't stopped us with SQL injection, right? And in this attack, and in a bunch of other attacks that we're talking about, our big friend is the CData field. So I'm not going to talk about it in detail, but it's basically just a way that XML has built in to get nasty stuff into XML, right? Things that XML that you don't want it to interpret as part of the XML document, you put it in the CData field, and it disappears. So I can put things like with single quotes and with brackets and all that kind of stuff into a CData field, and that goes into the XML parser, and then when you ask the XML parser for the string, it gets rid of that CData field for you. So the application never sees that you did that. There's also other escaping methods that work just as well, but the CData field is so powerful and easy, it's the best way to do it. Once again, XML schemas for defense. You can turn off CData fields in XML. Oops, that was Bex. So any questions on the XPath injection? And soon to be XQuery. Okay, I'm going to demo that at the end, because that's the cool one. SOAP is a standard where all of these like really cool web service stuff, this is where a lot of the magic exists. It's a standard that defines, I move XML around, that I can do remote procedure calls. I can do RPC calls. It's generally over HTTP, but it doesn't have to be. SOAP is defined by things called WSDLs. WSDLs are these really ugly documents that are never meant for human beings to read. They're meant for computers to read, and they're generated by computers. And the great part of them is that as an attacker, as somebody who's scoping out an application, the WSDL tells you everything you need to know to attack the application. So this is so much more powerful than we had for web application hacking, right? Because to do a web application hack, you have to start off playing with the application for days, using a user trying everything, and then mapping it out and seeing all this functionality it has, right? With web services, they just tell you up front. They tell you, these are all the things I can do. These are all the things you can ask me to do on your behalf, which is really, really cool, and it makes a lot of things a lot easier. Generally, asking for a WSDL is as easy as adding a question mark WSDL at the end of a document, and we have a tool that will do this automatically for you so you don't have to go through and do question mark WSDL over and over again. They define all this stuff. This is just for reference. You guys don't need to know. Basically, it defines something like if I had a service that sold used cars, it would define how I ask you to sell me the car, and then your response to me, and what that means. There's no way you can read this. This is like a third of a single WSDL for a very simple eBay thing. It's incredibly complex and dense. What's good about that? That means that the developers that wrote that almost certainly never read the actual WSDL. right? The WSDLs are generally automatically generated. Like my thing I wrote before, if you write a bunch of stuff that's accessible through web services and you turn it on, all of a sudden the WSDLs generated that tells somebody all those things so that they can point a web service at it and not have to talk to you about it. That's the whole idea. And so that often includes things like hidden debug messages. And I've actually seen this. This is a web application that was ported over to having web service support. And they had ported over all of their functionality, right? I think it had been on Struts or something. They ported out all this functionality over to web services. And one of the methods in the WSDL that obviously they had never read was make me admin. It was a debug call that the developers would have just normal low rights users could make that call and they'd become the administrator of the service, right? Now, they had that in the web application before and it had never been attacked. Why? Because it was a parameter you had to put into a post. And that's not something that somebody might not, you know, make me admin might not be something that you guess and that you shove into every single parameter in every single post. But I didn't need to try anything. All I had to do was look at the WSDL and it said it right there. Make me admin. It takes like a user ID for which admin you want to become, right? That has always existed, and now it's just really, really simple. There's also all these CRUF systems. Who here knows of like a 1 a.m. batch FTP job that they're embarrassed about, right? Come on. Yeah, right. It's unbelievable what's transferred over FTP in the middle of the night. Like, if I was a router engineer, I'd be all over it. All this kind of stuff's getting moved over web services. Nobody's ever thought about security for them before. Maybe they've been kind of hidden because you have to be on the right router at the right time to get the information. Now all you have to do is ask. And you can use something like UDDI to say, hey, tell me all of your secret services. We'll talk about that. So what's your defense? You can manually review the WSDLs. Everybody should know what's in their WSDLs that they're broadcasting in the world to make sure there's nothing in there that's supposed to be a private function or that you're really embarrassed is in there, like debug functionality. You can hand edit them. Like Google writes theirs by hand, I think, mostly for compatibility issue reasons. But the better part is don't have things like make me admin in your production app, right? Get rid of that before it gets out to production. So there's a number of different attacks with SOAP. One big one we'll talk about a lot, not a lot, but we've got a couple slides on, is application level denial of service through XML complexity. And SOAP obviously takes XML, but you're probably wondering, you know, obviously I probably can't give SOAP arbitrary XML, right? Because maybe a method only wants, it says, you know, buy a car, and all it takes is the VIN number. It takes one string. How do I shove arbitrary XML into that one string? Well, there's fun things called SOAP headers. SOAP headers are part of the message that almost nobody ever uses, but everybody listens to and reads. And they're there because, you know, all these things like WS routing and all the encryption standards and stuff use them. You can put arbitrary XML in a SOAP header because there's no definition of what can and can't go in there. And that gets read and parsed by the application. You can also do some source routing sometimes. Sometimes people have multiple applications they're exposing through web services, and so they have to make a decision on who you talk to when your message comes in. Well, sometimes that decision comes from the header, and that could be set by the application itself. If this is like a client that you downloaded or something, if you see something that looks like routing in the header, try other things that sound like they might be web service inside the application and see if you can get it bouncing off of different things on the inside. SOAP has a lot of session management problems. It doesn't have session management. Just like HTTP, it's you do a post, you get a response. That's it. That means people have to develop their own session management. A lot of people do dumb stuff, like they use cookies, right? HTTP cookies, they still work. Obviously, it's on a browser on the other side, but somebody has to understand it. Well, what happens to that cookie once it hits the web server? It's stripped off, right? Like this XML document's going somewhere. It's going to a mainframe. It's going to a database. That cookie doesn't go with it. And so this causes a lot of access control problems for people because they're setting these cookies and they never see them actually where they're making decisions, like whose bank account can you transfer money out of, right? So, you know, that's an issue. There's also all the old classical state issues. A lot of people have to implement their own state mechanisms. They haven't had to do it for years, right? They've been able to use WebSphere's or ASP's little cookie. So they're kind of old at it and they don't remember that doing things like counting up from 1,000 and then making the next user number 1,001 in that field is definitely a little bit guessable, right? As are things like counting up from 1,000 and doing a SHA-1 or something like that. So we see that all the time again with web services because people have to roll their own. So this is a SOAP message, yada yada. It's kind of generic. You don't want to be actually writing these by hand. They're really hard to write by hand to make them accurate. I'll show a little free tool that you can download that does all the communication itself. Remember, we don't have a web browser here, right? When we're talking to a web service, it's expecting another computer to talk to it. So we don't automatically get something that has a GUI on it to put information in. And then you'll see in a demo, there's this thing called soap faults. If something breaks, it sends a fault back that has a string. So who here finds can find the interesting part of this? All right. So what do you think this is here? What does that look like that we've just talked about? That looks like an XPath query. This is the default functionality of ASP.NET 1.1 Service Pack 1. If XPath breaks, tell the user. Tell the user exactly the XPath string that broke and how it broke. So, we'll demo all that in just a second. And then something I talked about was web services denial of service. This is, in my opinion, much more powerful. I'd rather have a good XML attack than 1,000 bots on a botnet to do a SYN flood. Why? Because I have a huge multiplier. I don't have a huge multiplier with a SYN flood now that somebody's got $100,000 Arbor boxes or not really nice net screens or something on the other side, but I get a huge multiplier with an XML attack against an application. And I have to look for this advantage. And often this advantage, well, we've explored two different types. We're not releasing the code because it works too well, but it's pretty easy to recreate it yourself. But you either do attacks against the parser itself or against the application and its database backend. And against the parser itself, you get very large multipliers of CPU time and memory, right? If I can send you an XML document, how hard is that for me to send you a text document, right? It doesn't have to be dynamically generated. I don't have to use .NET to create this document. I only have to write it once and send it with a Perl script. So I send it once. Okay, that's a couple cycles. I can probably do a couple thousand of those a second. When it gets to the other guy, he takes that document and he says, okay, well, you want me to download a schema and you want me to set the namespace. Now I'm going to build a model that represents this document. So I have the head node, which is A, and I have the child node, that's B. Oh, and B has a child node called B, and B has a child node called B. And repeat that 100,000 times, and then close B off 100,000 times, and that guy builds a object in memory in some heavy-duty language like Java or C#, where it's not that, memory management isn't that easy anyway. It uses a lot of memory, and it builds this huge object that's 100,000 objects long and deep. That is a huge advantage. And all that happens before it makes a decision what to do with it, right? This is just the parser. The application hasn't even seen that anything's happened yet. This is the magic pixie dust framework that's done all this work for you. It gives you a huge advantage. How big of an advantage? Well, we've taken down four enterprise level hardware with a real patched good web services server with one of these laptops. Right? CPU pegged them. Because, and I don't think the CPU was actually from the parsing, it was from all the memory management, because every time a message came in, it would build that DOM, and then it would destroy that object, and then do it again and again. Because we can get a couple thousand queries a second, or a couple thousand a second out of some, 20 threads of Perl. So that is really, really powerful. And that's, it would take a lot more than one laptop to SYN flood those four boxes, right? Especially if they have a real load balancer on them. The other attack we've looked at is database connections, right? Database connections are coming from a pool. There's a limit of how much they're pre-created, and then they're used. And they're usually not like, even for sites that have millions of users, they're something like 200 or 500, right? Because they're only used when the query is going across. So, like we said, this WSDL tells you all the things that it can do, right? And you can do all of those things, it's stateless. You can do all those things as many times as you want, generally, unless they're doing something very smart. And so what do? I go through this WSDL, I find something that looks like it's a very heavy-duty thing that it has to look up in the database. Somebody name a query in which you have to read a big table, and you have to do it every time somebody asks you. Login, right? If I log into a machine, it's got a big list of users, and I give you a username, especially if it's randomized and you don't have it cached, you have to go ask the database, who's this user? And so to create these user requests with random usernames and passwords over and over again is not very heavy duty. But it takes up one of these connections while it's asking that question over and over again. And this is a great thing against enterprise servers because often, especially sites that have been DOSed before, they have 20 or 30 or 40 front-end web servers. How many database servers do they have? One or two in HA, or maybe two HA clusters, right? And that HA is probably cold failover, so they're not actually running. So, and it's not considered a failure when you use up all the database connections, right? That doesn't mean the box is broken. It just means that the queue is filled up. And so we've also done this against an enterprise system where there's a ton of web servers in the front and two database servers in the back in an HA config. And with a couple of laptops, we choked the database server. The database server only had like 5% CPU used, but that connection pool was all used up because we did something that took a lot of time. Why doesn't this get caught in normal testing? Well, in normal testing, you don't log in 100,000 times over a course of 2 minutes, right? That's not part of people's regression testing. You log in once, and then you do the heavy-duty stuff. And so that kind of application-level attack, while it's been doable with web applications, is really easy with SOAP, right? Because the login, all I have to do is change a little bit about the particulars and maybe generate some random usernames, and my Perl script has destroyed a database box. In either case, there's some important things to remember. You have to have a legal SOAP request, right? You don't want it thrown out before it hits the application. This is especially in the database side. And then speed is very important, too. We used multiple processes with multiple threads, it is still a little heavy duty compared to like a Synflood, and obviously the attacker's position is given away. So that's a downside for the attackers. It's a good thing for the good guys, right? Because you have to use real TCP connections to move this stuff across. But you don't have to listen to that connection, right? You can make a connection, send them the post, and then drop it. If you're using your own TCP stack, then just stop listening. Don't send a reset. Let it respond, but you don't have to actually have that memory allocated to get the response. Makes it very, very efficient. We're also looking into ways to make it faster, like HTTP 1.1 pipelining. This is especially important with like SSL because I don't want to do an RSA transaction for every post I do. If I do pipelining, I just send them all up with like create a pool of 20 or 30 TCP SSL connections and send them up. Or things like XPath. Anybody hear about those crazy regex attacks that you can do denial of service by getting somebody to do a weird regex? That's really, really hard. Well, XPath, obviously, if I can do arbitrary things in XPath, I can probably do things, if I have XPath injection, that are really bad, even if I can't use it to own the application. Unfortunately, defense isn't very easy for this. For things like the SOAP header XML complexity, there's nothing you can do as an application developer in your application, right? Because like I said, the SOAP message comes in, even if it's not for you, you've never heard of it at your application. It's the WebSphere or it's Access Apache or it's ASP.NET that's doing it for you. So the only defenses against that are something like you have an XML firewall. This is one of the reasons they actually sell a couple boxes a year that looks at them and has limitations on it. You can set your own limitations. Like if you only do small messages, you use 50K messages, and you set that in Apache or IIS. And so that's important. There's no reason somebody should be able to upload a 20-megabyte XML file to you, right? Or you can do something like write your own Apache filter or with something like Apache mod rewrite or mod proxy to look for this kind of stuff. SACS is not vulnerable, right? Yes, sir.